Ireland is divided into 32 counties that runs from the top of Bloody Foreland right down to the very tip of Mizzenhead. This series, entitled A Country of Contrasts, is lucky enough to have an older person from every single one of those 32 counties tell us what life was like in their county growing up. And today we feature the county of Waterford.
Sean Baig, born on the 13th of the 4th, 1929, in a place called Clashmore, it's near Youghal. My father was a postman for 44 years. My mother was a housewife. There were seven of us in the family, three boys and four girls. And we grew up in that village that I mentioned at the start, Clashmore, and we went to school in Clashmore. And the school in Clashmore was only three doors away from where we were born and reared. And I was ruined because I was the master's boy, and I did not. I went to school most days with no homework and no books. Well, you see, I used to buy the master's can for his dinner, his billy can. And the key to school was kept in our place, so he was kind of dependent on me. He lived in Youghal, which was 7 miles away. Now, supposing that if he didn't turn up the following day and they had to get a substitute or something, someone had to open the school. So, therefore, they knew where the key was, and I went up, or someone of us went up and opened the door. And that was it. And locked it in the evening and brought the key down to our house and was hung up on a nail inside the door. And that was it. And as a result, I got away with murder. First, second and third were in the first room. And fourth, fifth and sixth were in the other room. And that's the way it was. And we had a lady teacher, a Miss O'Callaghan from Macroom. And she taught the infants up as far as third class. And she was a master teacher. She looked for a transfer. She was fed up with it. And she looked for a transfer. And she wound up in Swords in the County Dublin. But she only stayed there for some time. And she came back and she married a fella. And she finished out her time. And about 10 years ago, I got a letter one day from a past pupil saying that she would be whatever age she was and that they were going to make her a presentation. And would I subscribe? And I wrote back and I said, certainly, whatever the going rate was, I'd send it. So this was about maybe 3 months before the event. But didn't she die before it came? And we were devastated. She was a lovely, lovely person. But as for the pupils weren't lovely. They were a bad crowd and they knew nothing. That's a fact. We never even got a primary set. There was two fellas in the school. One fella is a Monsignor now in California or someplace. And the other fellas retired out of Waterford County Council. And the rest of us were hewers of wood and drawers of water. Useless. And when the day of the primary school, there was an outside teacher came in to supervise the exam. So that was all right. Anyway, when he was out in the title or wherever he was, there was a sum in the exam and we all copied it, but he did it wrong. We were all disqualified. It was a disaster, absolute disaster.
Irish step dancing was always a great feature in our pastimes, and dancing masters were frequent visitors to our parish from the 1850s onward. The dancing was usually carried out on a Sunday or a holiday afternoon in spring and in summer. The music was supplied by local fiddle players. In the 1930s, people became more sophisticated and looked for more sheltered places for dancing during the whole year round, and of course for longer and later hours for dancing. In a short time, some sharp-minded individuals saw a chance of supplying the need, which was also to be a source of revenue to themselves, and so came the introduction of the dance hall. Halls of all descriptions grew up like mushrooms in every town and village. And that's according to the website Beaufort Parish Community and to Pete Coughlin, who wrote the piece.
We all learned how to dance. And there was a couple in Clashmore, Anne and Tom Morrissey. They taught everyone. Annie Morrissey taught every child around there how to dance. And she taught me two brothers how to play the accordion. She was a gifted woman, no education, no nothing, but she was able to impart knowledge to people. Just thinking back, there were great times. You know, we hadn't a care in the world, you know. And there was, we made our own entertainment. There was no, well, there was an odd gramophone and radios. There was one radio in our parish. And it was in a place, a postman had owned it, a man by the name of Lairburn. And it was a dry battery. And the dry battery would be about that size and that, you know, huge, big thing. And the wet batteries had to be brought to Yarl every week. And a fellow by the name of Chaplin in Yarl, he charged them. And he would have anything up to 300 or 400 batteries and charged at one time. And he used to charge sixpence for charging. And we had two wet batteries. One went in and you got the one that was charging about that. And that's the way they went every week, in and out like that. And the Sunday after Mass in Clashmore, after 11 Mass, there'd be fellas hitting for Burns' house. And it was the only house in the locality that had a radio. And when they all learned to be on, they used to put the radio on the window, and all the kids and all the junior people sat in the garden outside, and the senior citizens sat in here. And me Hall O'Hare came along, and he described the match, and they thought that was out of the sunshine. That's a fact. He brought more pleasure to the rural Ireland than any other one. And he never described the match as being bad or dirty or anything like that. He always made the best of it. And this, well, he couldn't be contradicted. There was no television. He was a wonderful man, and they taught the world him. The wireless got a bad debt in the end, because what happened was Mrs. Burnham was a great De Valera person. And De Valera couldn't do wrong in her eyes. But there was a discussion on the on the radio this night anyway, and some fella said something derogatory about Mr. De Valera, and she was an invalid, and she scooped a stick and she hit the radio belt and made smithereens of it and said, "How dare you insult Mr. De Valera?" And that was the end of that. But a short time after, everyone had radios, you know what I mean? And then the transistor came along, and, you know, the world is a very small place now.
Hannah Monahall recalls her mother baking bread. She says she had no mod cons. She'd an open fire in the kitchen. On it, she cooked and baked bread in the bastable by putting the red sods of turf on the lid. The same bastable boiled the spuds. She had a smaller one for boiling the bacon and the cabbage, or whatever type of cooking took place. Bread sold as 2-pound loaves, a loaf being either standard shape called a pan, another called a basket being more ornate in shape.
There was no agers or anything that time, you know, an open fire, and my mother baked cake, and she cooked cake in a bastable, a round pot, and she put the what they call grease skein on the top of it. It was a fire that she'd rake out, you know, red coals, and she'd put them on the top of the bastable. And that's the way, and it was gorgeous bread. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and we got shop bread, as they used to say, as well, but she always baked cakes, and she was great at apple tarts and all that kind of thing.
Sean Lamass was born in Dublin in 1899 to a draper whose business was conducted on Capel Street. He is remembered for building up Ireland's industry and infrastructure and founded many state bodies to achieve this, such as Board na Mona, Aer Lingus and Irish Shipping. And that's according to a book entitled Sean Lamass, Biographical History, which is an unpublished biography of Sean Lamass and is currently held in the archives of UCD.
I remember my father used to keep a few sheep in that, and there was a man, Ned White, lot of them, he's dead now, and he sold, we'd say, 20 sheep. And there was one sheep left that the fella that bought the other 19 wouldn't take. And my father says to him, "How much for the sheep?" And he says, "5 bob." And he gave that sheep to me, and it went on for about 25 years. She survived and was looked after and everything, and was fed, and she had 2 lambs the first year, and, you know, it went on like that. But like I'm talking about the economic war, where England nearly starved us to death. Like, I have no time for the English. And that's the reason why, because they lived off us for years. We fed them for nothing. Do you know what I mean? Now, I'll give another example of how bad things were. We lived opposite the guards barracks. Our house was there and the guards barracks was there. And we often got up in the morning and the guards, the yard at the back of the guard station, there'd be cattle in it and there'd be sheep in it, and they'd be, after being taken by the bailiffs at night, they'd take them during the night because they couldn't pay the rates. No, they just didn't have no money to pay anything. Sean Lamass revolutionised this country. He was the father of prosperity as far as this country was concerned. Born and born started. And they said that the man must have been stone mad. How could you take clay up off the ground and burn it? That's what they said. And there it is, one of our main industries now. Because we have the raw material, you know what I mean? We don't have to import anything. Briquettes, everyone is burning them now. Excellent fuel. And, you know, he was way ahead of his time. And De Valera's there too long in power. And if he had let Lamass lead 10 years earlier, you'd have had a better country. Elections used to be hectic. Fellas fighting and everything. After Mass of a Sunday, a fella would be standing up in a lorry or something, a horse cart or something, and blathering out him, and the next thing some fellas heckle him, and the next thing there'd be fellas coming to blows. It was marvellous.
The role of the postman was valued, not just in Ireland, but across the whole world, as can be seen from an excerpt which featured in a letter that was posted to a newspaper called The Hindu by a man called R. Lennon from Chennai. And he says, "The postman knew everyone in our village personally. As soon as he entered our village, the news would spread and people would wait at their doorstep for him. The postman was a link in the social circle. I remember how a postman used to ask my sister, whose house I frequented during my college days, about my welfare, much after I'd left the place. He was more than a messenger. He was a friend and a well-wisher. And he used to share our happiness and console us in bad times."
He never ate a dinner in our house for I don't know how many years, from Monday to Friday. At 11 o'clock he'd be at Jack Corden's and Mrs. Corden and said, "Tom, the kettle is boiling. Hang on there and then make a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or whatever it was." And he'd have tea and biscuits there, or maybe sweet cake or something like that. And he'd go on for another couple of hours and he'd arrive at Foley's and they'd say, "Foley, Tom, you're just in time. Spuds are boiled. Come on in." And that was the way he lived. Everyone around that time, all the farmers, killed pigs. And we always got a good lump of a pig every so often. You know, and we never bought vegetables. There was bags of spuds delivered to our house. There was cabbage, there was turnip, there was, you know, we never bought anything like that. Well, now, I suppose he was unique because he was very flexible and you know, anyone that ever asked him to do anything, he did it. You know what I mean? So he built up a position of trust, and they trusted him with everything. No, he never got any money on. He didn't drink, and at Christmas time, if he wanted to, he'd be drunk every day if he wanted to, but he never drank. Before he died, he was in hospital, and they used to give him a drop of brandy, and that was the only drink. This was medication that they gave him in the hospital. He was a man that you could look up to, but he had a few weird experiences. There was an old, you know, postmen that time were social workers along with being postmen. You know, they kept an eye on people and all that. But there was a brother and sister lived in the road where he used to come down every day, and they never got any post. They had no light. They had no nothing. They never got any ESP bill or anything, you know what I mean? So he missed him anyway, and he got a bit suspicious, and he went up to a farmer's house that was near him, well, a mile away. And the two of them came down, and they went in, and she was lying on the floor, and there was nothing, only her skeleton. They didn't know whether rats attacked her before she died or after she died, you know, but death was all that was there. Yeah, oh, he was very upset over that. Now, there was a very understanding sergeant of the guards in the village at the time, and the sergeant said, look, he said, she was an old woman, I think she was nearly 90, and he said, we'd make arrangements to have her buried and all that. He said, and there was never an inquest, there was never an inquiry, there was never nothing. The brother was in hospital, and he died shortly after. And there were small farmers, like, you know, they had a farm of land and all that, and but they hadn't much now, to say the truth. But, yeah.
Within rural Ireland, there was a pattern of late marriages and a very high birth rate within marriage. The rate of immigration, especially for single women, remained high during the 30s and the 40s, with England being the main destination. By the 1940s, it appears that a general discontent with their conditions was becoming evident, especially amongst the rural population. Few women worked outside the home, and they usually lost their jobs on marriage. From the early 1940s on, sympathy was growing for the women in the home and the difficult conditions under which she had to labour. And that's according to the archives that are held in Muckross Research Library, entitled Ireland in the 1930s, the 1940s.
My mother went to yard once a year. That was it. She might buy a new coat or a new skirt or whatever it was. And, you know, but other than that, she never went anywhere. It was like every housewife at that time. She kept her thoughts to herself, and she didn't say nothing. Do you know what I mean? Women weren't heard of that time. Do you know what I mean? We had great neighbours, and our house was an open house. There was one for the Jack Fleming, Lord, I must have been his dead again, and he'd come to our place maybe at 11 o'clock at night, and my father would go to bed, and we'd be all sitting around the fire, big open fire, and he'd say, Jack, when you're going out, close the gate. And he might leave until 3 o'clock in the morning. And the next house he'd go to my aunt, which was another couple of miles away, and he'd do the same thing there, and he had around the house, so he used to. And he was as good as any woman. He could bake bread, he could iron, wash clothes, iron clothes. He could do anything.
The Redemptorists are a religious congregation of men who came to Ireland in 1853. They were to travel from town to town and parish to parish, bringing the word of God to the people. In modern times, this often means a parish mission, or what is also called a renewal. A Redemptorist will go to a parish and each day for a week or more preach special sermons, calling the faithful to a fuller practice of the Christian life. Redemptorist special preachers also conduct what is known as Triduums and Novenas, which are 3 and 9 day periods of prayer.
There was missions nearly every second year we used to have a mission. And, well, there'd be different priests come. But they were always terrified of their life at the Redemptorists. Yeah. Fire and brimstone. And there'd be two of them always come. And one fellow was very placid and nice and friendly. You know? And the other fellow was like a fucking briar. He'd eat you. And people used to be going to confession to the good fellow. Do you know what I mean? And the other fellow. But there used to erect a big tent outside the church, and these fellas used to come selling rosary beads and medals and prayer books and all sorts of, you know, and it would go on there'd be a week for the men and a week for the women, you know, and company keeping and all that kind of thing was the major sin. You could cut the head off a fella, or you could, you know, or you could kick someone to death. And if you were going out with a girl, that was worse than kicking the other fellow to death. And I'd give you an illustration of that. There was a guard in Clashmore, and he was doing a line with this one, and the next thing she was pregnant. And as I told you before, our house was there, and the guard's barracks was there. And there was two chief superintendents for a week attended the barracks to know what to do with your man. You know, it wasn't heard of. And if my memory serves me right, I think he was discharged from the guards.
You know.
Well, now, if a girl like that didn't come out very good out of the whole thing, they were ostracized. And that's the only way to say it. They were treated very, very badly by their own. And by their neighbours, and I mean, people wouldn't talk to them, wouldn't look at the side of the road again. I thought it was terrible, no, to say the least. And my father, I thought he was a postman, he went up to this place one day, and when he got up there, they had a brother. And the brother was deformed, he was only that size. And they never heard my father coming. And the day was so nice, they brought him out, and when they saw my father, they grabbed up their man and he was brought back into the house and he was never seen after until he died. And my father was the only one outside of the family that saw that chap. It was desperate, desperate. And people that should have known better. You know. No, I remember there was one fellow, I saw him, I went to see him, he was in hospital in Dungarvan, he died since. He was married to a girl. Her father attacked her with a 4 grand fork, and only for another man that was there that saved her, he'd have killed her because she was pregnant. And that chap was thrown out of that house, out of his own house, without as much as his bus fare to wherever he was going. And he hadn't as much as 2 shillings to throw up off another.
We take it for granted that there is a bank in every town and city in Ireland. There was a time when some thought that a bank in Ireland wasn't a feasible option. As James William Gilbert in 1836, in his book The History of Banking in Ireland, suggests, and he says, if the government be too feeble to protect one individual of the community against the rapacity of another, or be despotic and tyrannical so as not to circumscribe its own claims within the limits of law and justice, then few banks will be established.
We never went to the bank. The only people that went to the banks in our place was, but they were all farmers or business people and all that, but the ordinary working class never went near the bank. It was inferiority complex. You know, they were afraid to be seen going into the bank or coming out of the bank. You know, if people were saying, oh, Jenny, your man is in the money, he's going out of the bank. Do you know what I mean? And they had this complex that, you know, that they weren't good enough to be going into the banks. Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's a fact.
Blackberries go back to ancient Greek and Roman times, when they were picked and eaten fresh. The ancients believed the blackberry to be a cure for many illnesses, including throat ailments and gout, and many an aging citizen squeezed out the juice and used it to dye their greying hair. So says Gail Kavanagh in her website Plant Folklore.
And then after school in the evening, this time of the year, well, to be later than this, we picked blackberries for 6 pence a pound for blackberries. There was a fella that used to buy blackberries and they were sent to England. And they said that what they were used for in England is that they used them for dye for the Air Force, the blue. But we had a field day because 6 pence was a lot of money. We used to pick what they call fronds as well. Did you ever hear of fronds? Now they call them in our part of the country hursts, H-U-R-T-S. And they're small little things, they're like blueberries, but we used to get 6 pence a pound again for them. But by God, Catherine, it would take a long time to get a pound of them. They were so small. These grew in little bushes about that high, and a place called the Corn Gloss. It's a big hill out between Yarl and a place called Knockanore. And it was known as the Corn Gloss. The green hill or whatever. It was acres upon acres. Whole families used to just descend on this place picking these things. And they were exported to England as well. But then, as well as that, in the winter time, we used to hunt rabbits. And you got 4 pence, I think, for a rabbit. And myself and Moss Quine were digging out a rabbit one day, and the teacher came along, and Moss Quine says, hold on a minute, I haven't beat the arse. And the teacher told him at school the following day about the way we were carrying on, you know. And But anyhow, that's the way we got through life. Well, the thing about catching rabbits was you snared them. Now, and you could make the snares yourself. Some fellas used to make them. You buy the wire, or you could go along to most hardware shops, sold them, made. And you got a snare and a piece of string attached to the snare, and then you had to get pegs, and you pegged the thing into the ground, and you put them up in a little go-log stick, and the rabbit came along at night, and when you went out in the morning, you had him. Well, it was a necessary function, because you had to live along with the rabbit. You know what I mean? You had to get money somewhere, and that was a way of getting. So we did that, and we picked the berries, and you see, my father's wages were diabolical at the time, and still and all, he was well off in comparison to other people. I remember a fellow working 7 days a week for a farmer for 8 shillings. 7 days a week, and he got 8 bob at the end of that. Paddy Ronan was his name, and he went off. If he went to a match of a Sunday, he'd be back Sunday evening to milk the cows. You know, it was absolute slavery. We lived in the borders of Ring, and I should be a fluent Irish speaker. My father was a fluent Irish speaker, but we never practiced the thing. But he delivered to people that knew no English. Now, their sons and daughters went to America, and they'd write home in English, and he'd have to translate into Irish and read it to the people that Now, they'd dictate that to him in Irish, and he'd have to talk about complications. But he did it. He paid bills for people. He paid, you know, he was a highly trusted man. There was a little river in front of our house called the Gregor, was the name of it. And there was a little bridge over that. It was a kind of a focal point. And the senior citizens used to meet there every evening, and they discussed everything that happened that day. And that's when they used to all assemble every evening. You see, not everyone got the paper that time. Now, my father always got, because he was a postman, and he'd be down half an hour before he'd be due to be there, and he'd have the paper read by the time he'd start work. And they discussed the paper and all that. And I remember as well as if it was only yesterday.
My name is Caroline Brennan. Thanks for listening. This series has been kindly funded through the Sound and Vision Scheme, which is a funding scheme from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.